You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Just the Discs. My name's Brian Sauer, this is my podcast about Blu-rays. This week I'm revisiting one of my favorite labels, and that is Twilight Time. I have been a big fan of theirs for years and years now. They just seem to have my number, really. They just know what kind of movies I like. I mean, there's a lot of cult titles. I think when we did our Pure Cinema episode on Twilight Time, which I highly recommend you go check out because we talked about a ton of their movies on that one, I was realizing just how much the company's MO aligns with my own personal movie MO and the kinds of things they put out. So I do look forward to their announcements every month with great anticipation. Definitely look them up on Facebook, Twilight Time Movies, and keep tabs on what they're bringing out. They've got a lot of cool stuff coming in the next couple months. Just a quick rundown of some of their cool titles coming on February 20th. Manhattan Murder Mystery, Harry and Walter Go to New York. Very underrated movie with a great cast. The Incident, and then in March, I'm excited for Underworld USA, Sam Fuller's movie. The New Centurions, which is a great cop movie with George C. Scott, who's going to come up later, and Stacy Keach. And then The Seven Ups, which has one of the greatest car chases in all of cinema. Really fantastic movie. And then in April, Model Shop, Jacques Demy's movie. Autofocus, the Paul Schrader, No Down Payment, which is a really interesting and widely unavailable to this point. I think there might have been a made-on-demand DVD, but I saw this at UCLA years ago, and really interesting study of the suburbs in the 1950s. And it's been done a lot, the sort of darkness in the suburbs kind of thing, but I feel like for 1957, there were not a lot of movies like this. Really interesting. And then something called Blue Denim, which from 1959, which I'm definitely interested in checking out. So always good stuff from Twilight Time. I've got five titles to talk about here, and I'm going to start with Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice from 1969.
This could be one of those ultra-exclusive discotheque nightclubs where the jet set comes to play. But it happens to be a stage at Columbia Studios in Hollywood, where they're filming the Frankovich production Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, a comedy about two young couples who start out as best friends and carry on from there. Natalie Wood is Carol. Robert Culp is Bob. Elliot Gould is Ted. And Diane Cannon is Alice. To get this show on the road, the film's director, Paul Mazursky, maneuvers his stars through the madding crowd. If it's true that opposites attract, it's no wonder these two couples are as thick as thieves. While Bob and Carol are extremely mod in both dress and behavior, Ted and Alice are comparatively square. At first, anyway. Producer Larry Tucker, who co-authored the screenplay with Mazursky, describes the story as an indoor adventure. Sounds like fun.
The back says, Paul Mazursky's directorial debut, co-written with Larry Tucker, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, is a satiric comedy of manners focusing on two Eisenhower-era couples, Robert Culp, Natalie Wood, and Elliot Gould and Diane Cannon, who must confront the sexual revolution of the 1960s. They do this with varying levels of timidity and gusto, and the result is a sharp yet generous-spirited send-up of social mores, spectacularly acted by its quartet of anxious protagonists.
Don't tell me that you couldn't possibly make love to Carol.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Under no conditions.
Oh, is that a fact? Oh, you don't find Carol attractive?
Of course I find her attractive, and I love her very much, but like my sister.
I know you love her, man. That's not in question here. Does she turn you on?
Yes, in a way, but that's because of our relationship.
No, forget the relationship.
I can't forget about it. I can't forget our relationship.
I let a tennis pro do it. I would let you do it. Don't you see? Now, just give me an answer, yes or no.
So, here's the thing for me with this movie. I may have mentioned on the show, the 60s is a really tough decade for me because for some reason, some movies having to do with hippies and the counterculture of that period dates incredibly badly for me personally for some reason. And it just takes me out because it just feels so, earnest isn't the right word, but it was just a different time. I mean, as it would have been in the 50s and the 40s and the 70s. But for some reason, the 60s is a tough one for me. So I must admit that I saw this movie years and years ago, and I was like, oh, that's pretty good. It's okay. I mean, it didn't strike me one way or the other. And then I remember somehow Tarantino was screening it somewhere. Maybe it was the New Bev, and I heard him talk about it, or it was on a list or something. I can't remember. But he was sort of pushing it, and I was like, all right, maybe I should give this one another look. And I did, and it really surprised me. Like, it's just so well acted, you know? It's just a dynamite cast. I mean, I love Elliot Gould from this period. I mean, this is actually before some of his best stuff for me, The Long Goodbye and things of that nature that he would do in the 70s, The California Split. But he is so good in this movie. And Robert Culp is one of those actors that I feel like he's underrated now for some reason. Like, Gould still gets the love, partially because he's still alive. But Robert Culp is really something. He has this authenticity sort of thing that I can't quite put my finger on, but it's uniquely his, and he has a great presence. I mean, what's neat about this movie is that actually all four of these actors, Natalie Wood, obviously, and Diane Cannon, and the two men, any one of them could carry their own movie and have. So to have this great ensemble in the first film from Paul Mazursky, who is one of the very interesting American voices to come out of this period, and he comes out really strong. The movie starts with Robert Culp and his wife, played by Natalie Wood, going to like an encounter event at this specific place. It's in the sort of in the mountains somewhere, kind of in California. It was based on a real place, but apparently they wouldn't let them film there because they felt like when they read the script, it was making fun of them, which it kind of is, but actually the scenes at the beginning with this group, it's sort of that typical stuff that you've seen in some movies of this period where it's just like people trying to sort of really see each other and strip down their defenses and communicate on a, you know, a real personal level and do some role playing. And it's kind of goofy, but I don't know. It's still interesting as a time capsule, certainly.
Well, I had seen an article in Time magazine where Fritz Perls, a Gestalt psychologist, whatever he was, therapist, was sitting in a hot tub with some naked people up at a place called Esalen. So I told my wife, I think there's a movie in this. So we went up there. We went to Esalen. We were the only married couple. No one else knew. And that's how the idea sort of came about.
And actually, that scene is, I mean, you've essentially written that scene.
Yeah, in the beginning of the picture. And the thing is, Bob and Carol is loaded with New Age stuff where people think they've gotten insight. They're trying to be open. And it was a reaction to the closeness of, you know, the pre-war war and then even the 50s. But I don't know that it's much different now, really. I mean, as people were doing acid and this and that and the other, and today they're doing, I don't know what they're doing. Let me know if you've got any. But all that stuff is still going on. This was 1969, and all the New Age things are still, there's all kinds of everything.
I want to welcome you all to the Institute. My name is Tim, and I'm the leader of this marathon group. The leader's a bit strong, actually. I'm your guide. Now, as you know, we're going to try to go 24 hours without a break, and we will have 2 one-hour breaks for food. As far as sleep is concerned, that's up to you. There are no rules here. If you fall asleep, you fall asleep. One rule. No physical violence. I mean, you might get angry with someone, so please don't clobber him or her. Okay. That's the only restriction. We talk a lot about love, but we don't feel it a lot. So perhaps this marathon will open up some doors.
And so it starts with that, and after, you know, Culp's character is a documentary filmmaker, so he's going there ostensibly to try and see if there's a movie to be made about this stuff. And he and his wife have such an emotional experience that they come back, and the next scene is them having dinner with their best friends, this other couple played by Elliot Gould and Diane Cannon, and sort of, they're just sort of spouting the quasi-wisdoms of this event that they just went to, and trying to make it about, you know, being open all the time and communicating honestly all the time. And I think there's this initial resistance from the other couple just to be like, oh, come on, that's kind of baloney, isn't it?
I must say something now, which if I did not say it, I would be playing games with myself. Without, what was that look before?
What look?
You know, the one to Alice just before.
Oh, you mean that look?
I didn't see the look.
It was a put-down look.
Oh, now, come wait a minute. Bob, that wasn't a put-down look.
No, it's okay if it was.
It wasn't a put-down look.
And, yeah, it just turns into this whole thing of, like, the two couples trying to free themselves, and both sexually and just in general, you know. Culp's character, the first scene after this is he reveals that he's had an affair to Natalie Wood, and she, in the spirit of that event, wants to be accepting of that and is like okay with it. But, and eventually when they tell the other couple, it causes this big, you know, sort of stress between the two groups, because the Diane Cannon character just can't handle the idea that he's cheated on his wife and that she's okay with it. And, you know, to be fair, that kind of makes sense. But yeah, it's just got a lot of really interesting and frank scenes of couples discussing the nature of their marriages and their sexual relationships. One of the greatest scenes in the movie is with Elliot Gould and Diane Cannon coming home after hanging out with Culp and Natalie Wood. And Gould is feeling kind of frisky and trying to get Diane Cannon to have sex with him. And it's just this brilliant scene where she's like, I'm not really in the mood. And it sounds like something you've seen before, but it's got, again, an authenticity that I don't feel like I've seen too much in other films. So it's just really funny.
It's a comedy of manners, satire done in a, I think, a very elegant way, where you have to play with as much reality as possible, knowing that the situation will bring the humor out.
And there's a lot of humor throughout the movie. There's an emotional catharsis that also happens, and it's just a really neat document, the whole thing. Where it goes, where it ends, it's just a great announcement of a new, young American filmmaking voice in Mazursky. You know, he just really breaks out in this one. And yeah, it's a standout movie from this period. The special features include a commentary track with the Twilight Time folks, Julie Kurgo and Nick Redman, which is great. And then another commentary from an older, probably from the DVD, with Paul Mazursky, Robert Culp, Elliot Gould, and Diane Cannon, which is really interesting. Obviously, Paul Mazursky and Robert Culp are no longer with us, so it's wonderful to hear their insights and to listen to them kind of revisiting the movie after some of them after a long time, and just how funny they still think it is, which is not to say that they're, look at what we did. It's just more like, wow, this was a really special movie and we were all glad to be a part of it, that kind of thing. So really, really nice disc overall. Great to see this movie on Blu-ray. I mean, this is the kind of movie that could be a Criterion release easily, because it's just an important film. So definitely pick that one up. Next up is the George C. Scott film, The Hospital, from 1971.
Dr. Schaefer. Listen, did you know that Dr. Schaefer was in room 806 because he's dead?
Russ, what the hell are you talking about? You know what the hell she's talking about?
No.
I'm afraid I don't understand. What do you...
What Dr. Schaefer? Our Dr. Schaefer?
Our Dr. Schaefer, the one who's always grabbing everybody's...
Was he sick?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Now, what in hell am I going to tell this boy Schaefer's parents? That a substitute nurse assassinated him
because she couldn't tell the doctors from the patients on the floor? My God!
Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to be admitted to the hospital.
Do you carry Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Mr. Mitgang, if you don't mind? Do you have your card with you? Do you know your number?
There's no pulse, doctor.
What's the pressure?
There's no blood pressure, doctor.
Welbeck, yes, he just butchered another one of my patients.
We got a witch doctor in 806.
I built up one of the best damn departments of medicine in the world.
Maybe crazy, doctor, but I don't think this is your patient.
What the hell are you talking about?
A man comes into this hospital in perfect health. And in the space of 1 week, we chop out one kidney, damage another, reduce him to coma, and damn near kill him.
George C. Scott, in the hospital, where everything that happens is a matter of life and death.
We have established the most enormous medical entity ever conceived, and people are sicker than ever. We cure nothing! We heal nothing!
George C. Scott, in the hospital.
The back says, Paddy Chayefsky's magnificently dark comedy, The Hospital, produced by Howard Gottfried and handsomely directed by Arthur Hiller, stars a magisterial George C. Scott as the deeply depressed head of medicine at a Manhattan teaching hospital where, over one long night, everything falls apart. The doc's incipient suicide is interrupted only by the arrival of a seductive young woman, the delightful Diana Rigg, the daughter of a crazed patient, Barnard Hughes. She gives him something to live for and helps him get to the bottom of the bizarre sudden deaths suddenly plaguing the cold-hearted medical institution. So, for those who don't know, Paddy Chayefsky is the writer behind Network, which is another biting satire that I think a lot of people know, is seen as a classic in a lot of circles. And The Hospital, while not as good a film as Network, is equally interesting. And I feel like it should be a little more well-known than it is. All things considered, although, yeah, I mean, both films are pretty downbeat, so it's a, you know, kind of makes sense that maybe it doesn't connect as well, and hospitals are a little different now, but yeah, it's kind of crazy how much some things might seem to stay the same. I mean, obviously, you know, lawsuits have always been an issue for hospitals. They have to be very careful about malpractice, and I feel like it's a lot more... Well, we are a lot more litigious now, so things are even more carefully watched, I would think. But anyway, the movie opens very darkly, comedically, in that one of the first things that happens is one of the interns is found dead in one of the extra beds in a room where he had been having sex with another nurse from hematology or something like that. Apparently a nurse thought he was a patient and stuck an IV in him. And he was a diabetic, and the glucose, at least that partially helped bring about his death. So that's one thing, and George C. Scott's character is woken up by the phone call describing this. But it is played off in kind of a funny way. I don't know. It's weird. It's hard to describe. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously written by somebody who has a lot of things that they're trying to work out and illustrate on an intellectual level, and Paddy Chayefsky is one of the great writers who could pull this off with a comedic edge, the satirical edge that I think helps make the movie memorable. So George C. Scott, I mean, it was one of those movies where you watch it and he describes early on in a scene where he's trying to, people have been complaining basically that he's depressed. And so he goes to see a therapist in the hospital and he's like, I'm not really good at this, but, and he starts talking about his personal life, his family, and on top of all the problems they're having in the hospital, it just sounds horrible. And it was one of those movies where I'm like, wow, any particular issues I might be having personally myself are absolutely dwarfed by what he's dealing with. That is a truly, not that anybody should be suicidal on any level, but you listen to what he's got going on and you're like, wow, okay, I kind of get it. That's pretty rough. So anyway, he's just a really great lens through which to encounter the culture of the hospital and the problems that they're dealing with. And, you know, he meets this Diana Rigg character. She, of course, of the Avengers TV show. And she's really delightful. There's a lot of great, like, speeches, which I have a little trouble sometimes not being taken out of a movie when I feel like, oh, character's going into a speech now, and it doesn't feel, because there is some like stuff that feels almost, documentary's not right, but it feels more real, and then it'll go into these speechy sort of sections, and I feel it starts to pull me out a little bit, but it's still really well written and thought-provoking stuff. So ultimately, I don't know, definitely worth a look.
You're wasting your time. I've been impotent for years.
Rubbish.
What the hell is wrong with being impotent? Kids are more hung up on sex than the Victorians. I got a son, 23 years old. I threw him out of the house last year. Pietistic little humbug. He preached universal love. He despised everyone. Had a blanket contempt for the middle class, even its decencies. He detested my mother because she had a petty bourgeois pride in her son, the doctor. I cannot tell you how brutishly he ignored that rather good lady. When she died, he didn't come to the funeral. He felt the chapel service was an hypocrisy. He told me his generation didn't live with lies. I said, listen, everybody lives with lies. I grabbed him by his poncho. I dragged him the length of our seven-room, despicably affluent, middle-class apartment, and I flung him out. I haven't seen him since. You know what he said to me? He's standing there on the landing, you know, on the verge of tears. He shrieked at me. You old fink. You can't even get it up anymore. That was it, you see? That was his real revolution. It wasn't racism, the oppressed poor, the war in Vietnam. No, the ultimate American societal sickness was a limp dingus. My God. If there is a despised, misunderstood minority in this country, it is us poor, impotent bastards. Well, I'm impotent. I'm proud of it. Impotence is beautiful, baby. Right on, baby.
Special features on this disc include an isolated music and effects track and the trailer. This is definitely sort of a lesser heralded classic that I think more people should see. Next up is Dragon Wick from 1946.
The millions who read the book club selection Dragon Wick know the powerful emotional impact of its many exciting moments. For as the Ladies' Home Journal so daringly promised when it first published Dragon Wick, this is a story to thrill the hearts of those who loved Rebecca. Starring Jean Tierney as the woman who seeks love where it is feared to flourish, this unusual, impassioned romantic drama now comes to the screen with its fascinating plot and its magnetic characters brought vividly to life by a splendid cast, including Walter Houston, Vincent Price, Glenn Langan, Anne Revere, Spring Byington, and other outstanding artists.
And you're like peaches out of season, and the feel of silk sheets against your young body. And one day you'll wish with all your heart you'd never come to Dragon Wick.
You knew it the instant our eyes first met, and everything within us met. And you know it now.
You have no right to say that, to talk like this, please.
You can't help yourself any more than I. Am I right?
Miranda, you understand what I'm getting at, don't you?
Yes, I think I do.
I'd like to think that you might in time marry me, Miranda.
Jeff,
I suppose you're going to say it's a man. What man, I'd like to know? She's given frostbite to every mother's son in the county.
Perhaps the right one just hasn't come along yet.
Now, she won't find him with her nose stuck in the air, wanting what she can't get. A woman ought to get a man first and then want him.
Nicholas, let me help.
I don't need to be helped.
Help me, then. Please don't shut me out like this. Let me be unhappy with you and happy again. Let me be part of you. Let me love you and love me, too.
Now, this is one I had not seen, and it has a lot of things going for it that I really like. The first two things being that the main stars in the movie are Vincent Price and Jean Tierney, who, of course, you know, starred in Laura together. And I love that movie, so I am surprised that I hadn't gotten around to this yet. It's very much the sort of, you know, gothic tale with, like, dark undertones. Not as good as Rebecca or anything like that, but definitely interesting in that way.
Have you had a pleasant evening, miss? Oh, yes. This is a lovely room, isn't it? Yes, it is.
An unusual room.
It's unusually beautiful.
That isn't what I mean, miss. I do have such a time making myself understood. It's what she brought to this room and what'll never leave it.
Was she very young?
About as young as you.
She must have been very proud to be mistress of Dragonwyck.
He never loved her. He never wanted her at all. He wanted their son. He kept her from him. He forbade her to sing and play. He broke her heart and drove her... She prayed for disaster to come to the Van Ryns. And she swore that when it came, she'd always be here to sing and play. She killed herself in this room. This harpsichord.
That's just kitchen gossip.
Oh, you mustn't take me seriously, miss. No one ever does. May I take you to your room now?
Thank you.
Of course, I've never heard Azeel play myself. They say in the kitchen I never shall. Even when she plays, I should say if she plays. You won't either because you've got no Van Ryn blood. But he'll hear her. And Katrine.
The back says, based on Anya Seton's gothic historical bestseller, Dragonwyck was the first film in the storied directorial career of Joseph L. Mankiewicz, who obviously would go on to do All About Eve, among other things. It tells the spooky tale of an innocent country girl, Miranda, Jean Tierney, summoned to work as a governess at the magnificent estate, the eponymous Dragonwyck, of a distant cousin, the imperious Nicholas Van Ryn, Vincent Price. Despite the luxury of the surroundings and the romantic attentions of Nicholas, things soon begin to take a more sinister turn for our heroine.
I remember how the chapel bell rang on the day Johanna and I were married. Tonight it is soft and sad, but then it was loud and ugly, and my head ached with the noise. Johanna laughed and said it was a heavenly bell that would ring for us until death. We were never happy, but our life together was tolerable until Katrine was born. And then we knew that Johanna could have no more children, that I was to have no son. That there were to be no more Van Ryns after me, that I was to be the last.
I wish I knew something that I could say that would help you. I want to so much.
Do you, Miranda?
At an unhappy time like this, it must be difficult, I know, to think of anything else. But what has happened was beyond human control, Nicholas. You must have faith.
In God, I intend. I must not feel that my life is finished. And I won't. As long as you are with me.
The bell has stopped now. It must be nearly dawn.
Miranda, you've known as well as I that this was inevitable. That we were inevitable. I didn't know who you were. What? Where? Out of all this world, why should I have called to you and no one else? And why should you have come to me and no one else? It's because you were meant to.
So yeah, this was a neat little discovery for me. I like that Vincent Price did so many movies and that I'm going to be discovering them for a long time. I just kind of save them. I think that's part of the reason I hadn't seen this one, is I'm always kind of saving a Vincent Price movie here and there to check out when I can, and he doesn't disappoint in this. He's very sort of prim and proper and snobbish and elitist in this way that Vincent Price can pull off.
Are you ready to pay your rent?
No. Nor will you ever again get so much as a grain of wheat from me.
It is your purpose, then, to farm my lands and enjoy the privileges I allow you without making any return.
Your lands? Did you hear that? His lands! For 200 years, the Bleakers have worked the hill farm.
And for longer than that, it has belonged to the Van Ryn.
We've paid the worth of it many times over, and you know it. Well, here's the finish.
I'm sorry to hear it.
But since you feel that way, I order you to leave my land by tomorrow noon. If you are not gone, I shall have the proper authorities put you off. Have the next man step forward.
He's also very creepy, and things get a little unsettling with him later in the film. But Jean Tierney's great. She's just lovely and really portrays this naive farm girl quite well, you know, and just sort of this idea of getting like a sort of a dream come true scenario, a fairy tale scenario. She ends up at this castle, basically, working as a governess, and how it doesn't quite turn out like she would have hoped, I guess. But a really interesting story and great performances. Also stars Walter Huston as Jean Tierney's dad, and he's great. And Henry Morgan shows up. There's some other recognizable folks. Special features include the isolated music track, audio commentary with film historian Steve Haberman and documentary filmmaker Constantine Nazir, A House of Secrets, Exploring Dragonwyck, Jean Tierney, A Shattered Portrait, and Vincent Price, The Versatile Villain. Both of those were as seen on the Biography and A&E networks. And then two Dragonwyck vintage radio shows and a trailer. So a really well-stacked and good-looking Blu-ray from Twilight Time. A movie that's totally in their sweet spot and a great release. Definitely worth picking up for Vincent Price fans and fans of gothic, romantic, sort of creepy movies. Next up is one called Forever Amber from 1947.
Well, speak up, my girl.
I won't marry him. Amber.
What did you say, girl?
I'll never marry him. Nor any other farmer you try to force on me. Do you think I want to spend the rest of my life in a pigsty?
Go to your room. At once. I owe you my apologies, Master Starr. And you, Robin.
Matt. The girl's only out of humor.
I've borne enough of her humors and her sinful pride. Her vain ways have been a village scandal ever since she learned to walk. I've raised the vixen as my own daughter, and like my own daughter, she'll behave. If it means the skin off her back entire.
No quip, Matt. Please.
All right, no quip. But she'll have to learn once and for all that vanity is Satan at work in the female soul. I've stood the last of our nonsense. She'll marry Bob Starling, and that's the end of it.
Now, this is another one I hadn't seen. I'm aware of Linda Darnell, but I hadn't seen her featured so prominently as she is in this movie. The back says, Otto Preminger's lush adaptation of Kathleen Windsor's controversial best-selling novel, Forever Amber, tells the notorious tale of Amber St. Clair, Linda Darnell, an opportunistic wench who, hopping from bed to bed, rises to become the mistress of the roguish King Charles II, played by George Sanders. Meanwhile, she can only briefly hold onto her true love, the cavalier Bruce Carleton, played by Cornel Wilde, although she tries her best through the traumas of the bubonic plague and the Great Fire of London. Juicy melodrama, beautifully shot by Leon Shamroy and featuring a stunning score by the one and only David Raskin. So this is a really interesting movie, a good pairing with Dragonwyck, actually. It's not quite as gothic, but Darnell really digs in and is able to play this character wonderfully. Just, you know, sort of opportunistic is the great word to describe her. She really is that. She seems ready to, and willing to do anything to continue to sort of not have to go back to being a poorer person like she is at the beginning sort of the movie. But she's very good. You can see she just has something about her eyes that are just very, I don't know, they just pull you in. There's a sexuality to her that she conveys in this way that's really powerful, especially for a movie from 1947.
Well.
Oh, please, sir. You're not angry because I took refuge in your house?
fugitive?
Yes, I was returning from the tavern with the gentleman. He tried to force his attentions on me. But I eluded him and came through your door, which was open.
And where's the scoundrel now?
He was just outside a moment ago. I was waiting for him to leave.
If you wish him taught a lesson in manners, I'm at your service, madam.
Oh, no, please, sir. He's a very dangerous man. A notorious duelist.
I'm no stranger to swordplay myself, madam.
Open up now!
Who's there?
The watch! I beg pardon for disturbing you, Captain Morgan.
What can I do for you?
We're looking for a wench, sir. One of a band of footpads who cut a gentleman's purse up the alley here.
I see. What makes you think she's here?
She can't be far away. We were close behind her. She must have sneaked into a house along here somewhere.
If I see her, I'll let you know.
Thank you, sir.
Curse me if I didn't believe your tale. What am I to do with you?
You know what will happen if you give me up. They'll put a rope round my neck and hang me.
It's too pretty a neck for a rope, that's certain. But, sweetheart, I'm an officer of His Majesty's Guards and sworn to uphold his laws.
All I ask is that you don't give me up. Then when the watch is gone, I'll leave and you'll never see me again.
Where will you go?
I don't know.
You have no home?
Under the robber's den at Whitefriars. And there's a horrible woman there who has me in debt. She'll never let me go as long as I live.
This is the truth now.
Oh, yes. Oh, please believe me.
Morgan!
Coming!
Please help me.
There's one possibility that occurs to me. If you're willing to put yourself in my hands and do exactly as I say.
I'll do anything you say. Anything.
Morgan!
And it's an Otto Preminger movie that I hadn't seen, so I do enjoy his stuff. This is definitely a solid entry for him. And Cornel Wilde is great. You know, he's sort of in and out of the movie. And George Sanders is, I don't want to say I don't like George Sanders, but he mostly plays characters I feel like I'm not supposed to like or that I'm supposed to be slightly vexed with. And he just pulls that off beautifully. Like, I think he was kind of a dick in real life, and he just is able to translate that on the screen pretty well and carry that over. So he plays a good king. But yeah, it's an interesting period piece. And the backdrop of the plague and the fire is sort of unique for me, at least in seeing both things show up, gives this story this sort of epic scale that's really interesting for a melodrama. But great showcase for Linda Darnell. She does wonderfully with the role, and I want to check out more of her stuff because of it. Special features include an isolated music track and Linda Darnell, Hollywood's Fallen Angel, as seen on Biography and A&E Network. So a nice little special about her. Very cool. And lastly, I have one called The L-Shaped Room from 1962.
Our next attraction achieves a realism seldom presented in any contemporary film. We predict it will remain in your memory as an incomparable emotional experience.
Make you a promise. The first thing you'll hear when you wake up will be me telling you I love you.
The L-Shaped Room. The setting for a love story such as you have never seen before.
Do you reckon we should have a license? Those two are taking the test next week.
The L-Shaped Room. A story of two young strangers alone in a city of millions.
We don't want this sort of thing in broad daylight.
What are you talking about?
You know what I'm talking about. There's too much of it going on.
Leslie Caron, the girl who lives in the L-shaped room. Tom Bell, the rebellious writer who falls in love with her.
I know I can't afford it. I can't afford any of the bloody decencies of life. I can't afford to take you out. I can't afford to buy you a proper Christmas present. I can't afford even to be able to tell you not to worry. Look, I'm 28 years old and I'm still living from hand to mouth like a bloody tramp.
The L-Shaped Room. A story both intimate and bold.
Took no precautions at all, I suppose. No, of course not. No, that would have spoiled the wonder of it all, wouldn't it? All that nasty clinical stuff. Yes, I know all about that. Well, what's he going to do about it?
I'm sorry?
Well, the young man, the proud father-to-be.
I don't see it's an aspect that concerns you, Doctor.
The L-Shaped Room. A story both sentimental and jolting.
I love you. That isn't a dirty word, is it?
All I've had is two men. I'm 27 and only twice. That's all it's ever happened. So what does that make me?
Now, you've got that inside you.
Living there, and it's not mine. Do you understand that? It's not mine.
Leslie Caron. A remarkable performance in one of the most stirring love stories the screen has ever dared tell.
The back says, based on Lynn Reed Banks' best-selling novel, The L-Shaped Room, tells the tale of a young woman, the superb Leslie Caron, unmarried and pregnant, who takes a bedsit in a run-down London rooming house to consider her situation. Screenwriter-director Brian Forbes brings to vibrant life an eccentric community of misfits who become a kind of surrogate family.
I'm stopping it all. Just behave yourself.
Yeah, what's up? What's the matter with you? Gotta have a giggle on Christmas Day, ain't you? Ain't that right, Sonia?
Just a minute, dear. We're just getting to the interesting part.
Yeah, shut up a minute and turn that thing off. Place it like a bedlam.
Oh, don't be stupid. They're watching it.
Who are? Oh, you're watching it, are you, dear? Well, you sit down, Charlie. That's your age.
Listen, I was acting my age last night and you didn't grumble, did you, eh? If we shut up in bed, we can see the sea. Oh, are you all right, love? We'd like another one.
You're going on a long journey. Definitely a journey over water, but there's a silver lining at the end of it. Oh, wait a minute. This is interesting.
Oh, blimey, Colin has ever seen something.
All right, but not from you. Mavis, you give us a song.
Yeah, come on, Mavis.
What's that, dear?
Well, give us one of your songs. Doris has been telling me.
No, I couldn't do that now.
Of course you could.
I haven't got me props.
Well, I'll get them for you.
Oh, go on, Mavis. Anything to shut you up. Go on,
Mavis. Come on, Mavis. Don't let the professor down.
You really want me to?
Of course we do.
So you will have... Well, all right. I've got to get something first.
Now then, who wants another drink before she comes back?
Well, I'll have one.
Not you. Sonia? How's your glass, dear? I knew there was something I wanted to say. Where's Toby? I haven't seen him.
He's lying down, I think. He wasn't feeling very well.
What's he got? Morning sickness? Don't mind me, dear. I've had one over the eight.
You've had eight over the eight, you lovely bit of grub at you.
Charlie!
Oh, love, it's Christmas, isn't it? Ta-ra!
Hello, chaps. I thought this was a stay party, so I came alone. Swish!
Well, come on, everybody, sit down. Charlie, you go and play the piano. Johnny, you sit over there. Turn the telly off, will you, dear? Behave yourself.
The stunning cast includes the wonderful likes of Tom Bell, Brock Peters, Cicely Courtnage, and Patricia Phoenix. Beautifully shot by Douglas Slocum and featuring incidental music by John Barry. Yeah, this is another one that I hadn't seen, and like Forever Amber and in Dragonwick, in a lot of ways, I guess, a great showcase for an actress in Leslie Caron, and the sort of kitchen sinkness of it, the way that she's clearly, not, I don't want to say afraid of men, but like rightfully has been made suspicious of men, so there's a certain tension surrounding her walking around at night, her going to her room, people in the rooming house. Initially, you don't know if you can trust them, and you feel how she kind of is paranoid and obviously going through a lot. She's like the back says, she's unmarried and pregnant, and that doesn't come out immediately, but it is interesting to see how she gets to know the people in the rooming house, and again, that sort of familial relationship that develops. It feels like a movie of the 60s, and like I said, 60s is tough, but it's a really good-looking movie, and Caron is surprisingly, for me anyway, I don't know, I don't have a problem with Leslie Caron. I just have always thought she was fine. She's very, you know, solid, but this really gives her an opportunity to display what she can do, and it's a meaty role that she really makes the most of.
Were you excited when you saw the part as it was written for you?
When I first read the part, there were moments in it where Jane was too tame, and as the women of that day, she accepted things. She was a bit of a victim, right, and didn't fight back. And I had a meeting with, at that point, James Wolfe was my correspondent, Jimmy Wolfe. And I told him, I think she's too tame. I think she must rebel, especially in the big scene on the staircase. And he said to me, well, talk to Brian. Have it out with Brian. So I had a meeting with Brian, I think in a hotel lobby or something like that. And I was talking to him and giving him my arguments. She's too passive, she's too tame, she accepts everything. And he was doodling, you know. He seemed to not pay attention to what I was saying. He wasn't looking at me, he was just doodling on a piece of paper. And finally I stopped thinking, it's so rude. He's not even paying attention to what I'm saying. And he handed me the piece of paper he was writing on and said, is this what you mean? He had rewritten the scene while I was talking, and he presented me with a perfect scene, and that's the way we played it.
So another pleasant discovery that I wouldn't have seen if not for Twilight Time. Same thing with Forever Amber and Dragonwick. Really cool, the kind of stuff that they put out. So this one features an isolated music and effects track, and another great audio commentary with Lem Dobbs, Julie Kurgo, and Nick Redman. I do love it when they bring Lem into the mix, screenwriter of The Limey, among other things, a really fascinating film fan, and I can't get enough of commentaries with him involved, so definitely interesting to hear the affection they have for this movie. But that is it for my Twilight Time episode. Definitely check out their releases on their Facebook page, Twilight Time Movies. They're on Instagram and Twitter, and they sell their releases through screenarchives.com if you want to check out what they have. They've been doing a lot of sales lately. Definitely see if there's anything you've been wanting to get from them that might be on sale. Maybe join the mailing list for Screen Archives to be told about sales. It feels like every couple months I'm seeing a sale from them. So if you've been holding off, definitely join up and pick up a few of their discs, because it's quality stuff. You know, Criterion quality stuff, and a really great company that I think everybody should be supporting, you know, if you're a serious film fan. So thank you so much. Have a wonderful and Blu-ray filled week, and I will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.